This podcast is brought to you by the Albany Public Library Main Branch and the generosity of listeners like you.
What is a podcast?
God, Daddy, these people talk as much as you do.
Razib Khan's Unsupervised Learning.
10% of pediatric cancer is linked to a single gene variation. These variants can be detected in embryos before pregnancy begins. ORCID's whole genome reports can help mitigate your child's risk for cancer by screening for 90-plus genetic variants linked to pediatric cancer. Discuss embryo screening and IVF with a genetics expert. Hey, everybody. This is Razib Khan with the Unsupervised Learning Podcast, and today I'm here with my friend Akshar Patel. Akshar, can you introduce yourself?
Hey, everyone. My name is Akshar. I run The Emissary, and I'm an Indian American. I just took the jump into doing this full time. Previously, I was mostly doing a financial analyst for work, but right now I'm running a platform which seeks to examine a new India as well as old, and seeing that churn in action, and a little bit of examination into diaspora as well.
Yeah, so I guess like the first question that I have is like, why is this necessary? I mean, don't we have the media?
Dude, I remember I got into India like, I mean, really interested in into India around like less than 10 years ago, I'd say, probably like 7-8 years ago. And I noticed there was a huge chasm between like what the mainstream was saying and what Indians in India were saying. And that dichotomy, I guess that's what really piqued my interest. And then recently I went on a bit of a journey across India, across the south, the west, the north mostly. And you get to see a country in motion, really. And you get to see a country that's very different than the one that's in the New York Times.
Okay, so what is the biggest difference?
The biggest difference is Indians seem to have a huge sense of optimism to them. If you followed, say, the New York Times or Washington Post or Atlantic for the past decade, you would think that there's a genocide happening in India or civil war or like economic meltdown or something really crazy or people hate the government. There's obviously a good amount of criticisms of the government and many of which are, you know, valid. But in general, there is something I noticed when I was traveling across India. And I would try to talk to as many people as I could from every part of society, up and down, practicing my terrible Hindi. Something I noticed is people felt like, hey, like our time is now. Like something is changing in the air here. Something's changing in the dirt here. There's a new India coming.
Well, okay. So let me just ask you real quick. Mostly what a lot of the listeners are going to know about is Modi, who was described, I think, in the New York Times as a strong man recently. So I guess there is a debate on whether India is a democracy or not, whether it's liberal or not, all of this stuff. I think India, you know, can be described in the New York. Look, if you read the mainstream media, I think India would be what Fareed Zakaria described as 25 years ago as an illiberal democracy. What do you say to that sort of statement?
I think that's actually a pretty good description. Indian society is fundamentally conservative, but at the top, there's this strong upper crust inertia of extreme liberals, super Anglophile. And across India's history, there's always been a clash with that. I think that results in a liberal democracy. You know, they don't have the same sense of free speech as us, like many other countries like Europe, Africa, and, you know, in Asia. But they don't have a similar sense of justice as us or equality. And that's India for good and the bad, I'd say.
Wait, what do you mean they don't have a similar sense of justice? I want you to unpack that.
One thing I don't like about India is there are laws that discriminate people based on caste. And obviously there's a very famous reservation affirmative action policy, which I think in its inception was very reasonable. Now it's ballooned and stuff, but more so what I'm talking about is something like the SCST Act, which is almost nearing like a blasphemy law where, say, if an upper caste person says or is accused of, you know, hurling an insult or discriminating against a lower caste person, they could be thrown in jail like automatically. That's kind of wild.
So if I said Chura in India, I could be thrown in jail?
I'm not as good as cast names as you are.
I'm gonna get a few comments, but whatever. It's America. Nobody knows what that means.
Yeah, but I think it happens across the spectrum too. I think every identity group in India, or most identity groups, say they're being treated unfairly, but they don't. You know, most of them aren't at the point of revolt. There's always that little tribalism, that zero sum mentality, because of laws like these.
Yeah, so let me, you know, a lot of the listeners, you know, they will know that I've written about caste and stuff like that. India is obviously very diverse. You're talking thousands of what they call communities. And so it's a really complicated situation that varies by region, as you saw. And you were talking about affirmative action. India started in this path in the 1950s, or like, I guess the late 40s, like right after independence. And it has a very, very well defined, articulated affirmative action reservation system that applies in different states differently and in different, like, you know, aspects of the government. So it's, for example, like in tech, my understanding is there is no reservation, but in government jobs, they're copious, right? And you have a situation where there are parts of the country where, you know, 60 to 80% of the population or whatever has some level of affirmative action. I mean, basically, the tribal people and the scheduled caste, like the Dalits, you know, like 10 to 20% of the population have a lot of affirmative action. And then you have this whole middle group of other backward castes, OBC, which is basically whoever decides they are. You know, it seems like it's always contested. I mean, it varies by state to state. And then you have kind of the general category, the upper castes, which basically that's the good majority, like that's like 85%. Like last I looked at the census of Hindu Americans who are Indian, 85% would be general category in India. Whereas I think in India, that's like 30% of the population.
Yeah, 2030 about.
Yeah. And so you have like this really diverse country that we in America see these generalizations about. You know, so obviously you're not a Muslim, you're a Hindu, but there is a lot of talk about, you know, religious oppression and marginalization and all that stuff. But, you know, you might not be a Muslim, but you are an American, so you have an outsider view. So, like, tell me what you saw.
One, I think there's a Pew survey that really delves into Indian Muslim attitudes towards, I don't know how they feel about India, how they, you know, feel about other religions in India. It's pretty overwhelmingly positive. They feel pretty included. They feel, you know, not necessarily persecuted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a data. However, like when you go onto the ground in India and say, try to put yourself into, you know, the shoes of a Muslim or a Muslim, and you look at your WhatsApp, basically. Imagine you're part of a WhatsApp, like you're a Muslim family, you look at your WhatsApp, or you're on the street. I can understand the point of view that a lot of Indian Muslims say they feel, a lot of, I don't know, spokesmen for Indian Muslims say they feel that there is a sense of, you know, alienation or persecution, or more so, I think alienation is a better word, feeling definitely different than how Indian Muslims did back in the day, in a negative way. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So is this having to do with the Hindutva, Hindu nationalism, the idea that India is a Hindu nation? Is that the issue?
Yeah. I think because there's been a lot stronger assertion of Hinduism as a political idea. So Hindutva. And I think that's the main asset or facet of it. When I was traveling in Delhi and I went to Jama Masjid and I talked to some of the people there, like there was a Maulana there, there was a Muazzin there. So these guys are clued in, high ranking members of like the Muslim community. This is their opinion, that a lot of this is caused by the BJP and not necessarily other parties. Now, I think personally, from I guess my analysis, I think a lot of this is to do with the fact that in India, there's not a secular law. Like what I reference in terms of justice and treating people equally, India does not have a universal code of laws for like a Muslim, a Sikh, a Hindu, a Christian, et cetera, et cetera. There are separate codes, and this also extends to institutions and stuff like that. So in certain ways, certain minorities, I would say, have maybe extra positions of power or extra leeway in certain aspects of society. That is starting to be taken away. And that feels like, you know, hey, you're taking away my rights at that point. So I get it from both ends, I'd say.
So when I applied for my multiple entry visa, a couple of months ago, there was a field for religion, and I could not select no religion.
Really?
Yeah,
that was kind of interesting.
So I selected other. I don't know. It's just, I wasn't going to select any of the religions because I'm not religious anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's just they didn't bother to think that someone that would be visiting India would not have a religion. You know what I'm saying? It's just like goes to show you like just the mental straitjacket people are in.
That is fascinating. I would have never assumed that. I mean, I get what you're saying because in India, what you're born into, it is an attachment. In an almost ethnic way, like what religion you're born into. There's a lot of, there's definitely a lot of Hindu atheists, quote unquote. But I've even seen, especially in the elite sections, there are non-practicing Muslims who are very into their Muslim culture, but don't really, you know, pray and stuff like that, or even maybe even believe.
Yeah, many years ago, I actually met a guy. He was from Kerala. He was born into a Christian family, a Jacobite Christian family. But he married a Hindu woman, and his personal religious beliefs were pretty much Hindu. Mm-hmm. But he would complain to me that like all of his in-laws would refer to him as the Christian, even though he was a more regular temple goer than any of them were. So it's like, he would just like complain to me. I mean, it wasn't like a big deal, but it was annoyed him that it's like what he was born like dictated people's perceptions. And that's just how it is there, I guess, right?
Yeah, I don't necessarily know why that is, but I'm guessing it's something related to maybe caste or sub-regionality or things
like
that.
Well, I mean, so many people do not, you know, yeah, people are born into their community, they marry in their community, so it's like, you know, the idea. Well, so I remember, you know, our friend, we have a mutual friend, Mukunda Raghavan. I remember telling him once that he's Indian-American. And like he's a very cosmopolitan guy. Don't need to get details of his personal life, but he's just a typical American bro, lawyer, friend of mine in California. But he was shocked when I told him that 40% of Americans change their religion in their lifetime. Whereas like in India, that obviously is extremely low.
Yeah. Very, very low. I guess it's because of one thing I definitely noticed in India is their definition of diversity is completely different than, say, our American definition, where we're more of a melting pot. The ways I've heard described over there, it's like, oh, I don't know, like a thali, like, you know, those huge thalis with like 12 different items, even a salad. But thali was, I guess, especially the one described.
Well, because in a thali, it's like what? Like everything is separated. There's a lot of different things, but they're very distinct and separate.
They only mix sometimes. So I think that was a good description because that's what I saw, especially even in big cities. That was one of the craziest things. Like there was a guy I met. He was super nice. Name's Rohan. He showed me around Mumbai and he was telling me about like these different quarters. Obviously the Parsi quarter, the Hindu quarter, Muslim quarter, these historical quarters. But then it went down to region and sub-region and caste. So I'm not going to, you know, give too much information about his personal life. But basically, he was telling me about a scenario where there was a member of his community and his sole occupation for his entire life, pretty much, now he's retired, is he did a catering company just for his subset region and just for his caste, basically. So that he ran that his entire life. And he did well for himself.
It's because they have a very specific dietary, right?
Diets and customs and everything like that. So that becomes very salient in a way that for, I guess, outsiders, it's very difficult to understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you have to experience it. So wait, what is the, I mean, I know you've gone to India before, I think. So like, what is this the longest period you've gone though?
Yeah, for sure. And this was the first time I went like mostly solo. So that was quite a shock, especially for a person who does. I mean, I could understand Hindi decently. I could speak Hindi to pass by. But in the South, it was very different, where a lot of people, they didn't speak Hindi, and a lot of people also didn't speak English. So navigating that was a bit difficult, but it was fun.
Okay, so they didn't speak English, so they didn't speak Hindi, so you know they were speaking Tamil or whatever. So how did you make yourself like understood? Was it Google Translate?
Yeah. Technology was a big plus now, dude. Especially like with AI and Translate and ChatGPT, I use a lot. That really helped me get by. Especially with like obviously the upper echelons of society, they'll be speaking English. But say you need to get a cab, even say an Uber, a lot of these guys, they just didn't speak English as much, which I found was kind of surprising. They would speak a bit, but not as much as
So I guess, you know, here's a question I have in terms of logistics. What's the information technology, like, accessibility, like Uber's everywhere? Like,
Uber's everywhere in cities, but when I went to rural areas, it was a lot less accessible. And that's when you really needed to, you know, get on the street and catch a rickshaw and really talk with the locals and stuff like that. So, like, especially I was in the rural areas of Gujarat visiting with my family, and I couldn't catch an Uber. I just had to, you know, find my way.
Okay. Wait, so could everybody recognize that you were American just by your mannerisms or?
Some people could not, actually. One time I wore, funny enough, I wore like this plain white kurta, the classic, you know, like Rahul Gandhi type look. And that was the day I went to Jama Masjid, and people would be assuming I'm from Delhi proper. I guess I just really hit the look that day. But yeah, not as many comments about like my mannerisms or skin tone or stuff like that. Yeah, I was kind of surprised. 10 years prior, I got a lot. They could tell me out instantly. But now,
do you think that's partly because of convergence between India and the US in a lot of ways?
Yeah, and I noticed this when I went to the cities, especially somewhere posh like South Bombay or Bandra or certain parts of Delhi, but especially in Mumbai and Bangalore, I'd say you'd see people who look Indian American, and I don't know how to describe it, but like in 2012, which was the last somewhat long trip I went. Actually, 2005 is another really long trip I went. And I went in 2023 as well, but we'll go 10 years back, a decade back. That's better. I would not see people look like that, if you know what I'm saying. Like, yeah, second gen Indian Americans.
I mean, they could have been, though. There are people that go back, but I guess what you're saying is just a convergence.
But then I hear
That's the thing. Yeah. Okay, so there's been a convergence. So it's like, you know, through the internet, English language and stuff, there's been a convergence, right?
Yeah. Fashion, I think also nutrition maybe as well. I don't know. I literally don't know. It's really strange, but it's cool. You know, no hate.
So you were in the South. Wait, did you go to Chennai?
Did I go to Chennai? I think I did, yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I went to Chennai, yeah.
So this is a big country, you know, obviously. And, you know, if you go to the U.S., you can tell that, you know, you're in the South versus the Northeast versus the West. There's some generalizations. What did you see? Like, what jumped out at you besides, like, the obviously, okay, people in the South are smaller, darker skinned or whatever, you know? But, like, but in terms of, like, day-to-day, you know, like the way people interact, the way to get around, like, mm-hmm. From your perspective, is it a relatively homogenous national culture?
No, definitely not. One thing I learned and I appreciated in India, especially the solo parts of my travel, was that, like, look, like, I have a strong belief in Indian unity and, like, the project of India. I think it's a very amazing thing. I've always had less than, you know, positive attitudes towards Indian regionalism and linguistic states, which I think are new. I mean, they are new inventions. Like, that's the truth. However, as I traveled India, and especially after I went to Gujarat and Mumbai, which has a large Gujarati population, I understood the appeal of Indian linguistic regionalism and why it's very important to people. I felt way more at home in Gujarat and even Mumbai, which I was totally solo, than most other places in India because of that linguistic link and that cultural link.
Well, so it's just you could understand the speech on the street, the idioms, stuff like that.
That and also there was definitely differences in how people acted. Like, people from NCR are notoriously like
what's NCR?
National Capital Region, which is around Delhi. So it's a sprawling region spreading out in Delhi, Haryana, Uttar Pradesh. Very, very developing region. It's very dynamic. However, people from around there are they're a bit notoriously like standoffish versus if you go to Mumbai, people are a lot more cosmopolitan and nicer to you. Bangalore, I think people are a bit more reserved. They're nice too, but there's a bit more extroversion in Mumbai.
And well, I think what I've heard is South Indians tend to be more reserved than people from the north, especially Punjabis, but maybe that's I mean, that might be anyone versus Punjabis, right?
Yeah, yeah. Punjabis are special, that's for sure.
Wait, so did you go to Punjab, or are you mostly in Delhi?
Mostly in Delhi, but Delhi is in a way an extension of Punjab.
Yeah.
And even Haryana itself. The culture, it's a continuum. So there's a lot of Punjabis there anyway. So it's a big part of the culture.
I think maybe Delhi to Punjab is kind of like Mumbai to Gujarat, right?
I'd say maybe, yeah, I'd say that or closer. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, because geographically, there's no separation. Yeah. Well, it borders on Haryana, right?
From what I know, and I don't want to be a bit, you know, regionalist here, but I've heard Gujaratis were kind of imported into Mumbai as it developed. Because it's a bit of a recent city in terms of becoming big. So I think the British imported a lot of Gujaratis. They did a lot of business there, especially like the Parsis and stuff, but also Gujaratis in general. So they kind of really built up the city in there for multi-generations. From my understanding, Delhi is a very historic city. However, it just has had a recent boom with the influx of Punjabi migrants or refugees from partition. So I think its Punjabification is maybe a lot more recent than the Gujaratification of Mumbai.
Yeah. So yeah, because like during partition, you had, you know, Pakistan, India, they basically swapped.
Yeah. 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 So they've done very good for themselves. I think it's a great story for the Punjabi community. They've really done very well in Delhi.
So let's loop back to caste. You're anti-caste, I guess, or whatever. Like, you don't think much of it, but you know, you went to India and you kind of indicate that the country is still defined a lot by that social cultural feature. So one of the things that I have said, and this is just based on numbers, not personal experience, is that the interaction between peoples of different communities is just too great for this institution to.